It's the tropical island getaway with a famous sunset view at the start of U.S. Route 1, Key West, Florida. It's barely 4 miles square. The town's laid-back atmosphere comes complete with chickens strolling in the streets and 7-toed cats lounging in the shade. Key West was a magnet for writers and artists back in the 30s and in the 70s. They often went there to reinvent themselves or just soak up the atmosphere of that never-ending cocktail party. Tennessee Williams, Hunter S. Thompson, Jimmy Buffett, and, of course, Ernest Hemingway. They're just a few of the notables who've left a mark on the island. In fact, this year's annual Hemingway Days Festival starts on July 15th. Joining us right now on Travel with Rick Steves with stories from the Conch Republic is William McKean. He chairs the journalism department at Boston University, and he's the author of Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Key West has really been a magnet for literary types. You compare it to Paris of the 1920s.
You know, it kind of was. Hemingway, of course, is the one that sort of put it on the literary map and lived there for a decade or so. But it was also Robert Frost and Wallace Stevens and Tennessee Williams moved there in the 40s. But there was a real great collection of talent that was there in the 1970s, including Thomas McGuane and then Jim Harrison, eventually Jimmy Buffett, Philip Caputo, Shel Silverstein, you name it, they're there. But I focused on the McGuane, Harrison, Buffett group in my book.
And why did you focus on them?
Because they had a really good story to tell. I think that Tom McGuane was sort of a rock star of writers back in the beginning of the 70s. You didn't have to read books to know who he was. He was this tall, lanky, long-haired, crazy hippie writer that everyone, all the critics were calling the new Hemingway. And so there he was living in Key West, sort of baiting that challenge. At the time, I'm sure it opened a lot of doors to be the new Hemingway. I think it became kind of an irritating thing for him. But, you know, there he was kind of on Papa's turf there to face off and sort of prove his literary chops. And, of course, he went on beyond being the new Hemingway and just became Tom McGuane, which is, in my view, at least a great American institution in literature. But also he struggled a lot in the 70s, and he had a reputation as this crazed alcoholic drug abuser nicknamed Captain Berserko, and he came out of it. And I saw this book as being a book with a happy ending, because here's a guy that, you know, redeemed himself through his talent and through his will. And there was a period there in the mid-70s where I think he had 3 wives in 3 years. Well, now he's been married to the same woman for 35 plus years, hasn't had a drink, a drug, or anything in 35 years. So I responded to that part of the story, to his redemption.
You know, reading your book, it occurred to me a lot of these people went down there and they kind of found what they needed, and then they end up going to Montana or something like that and living happily ever after.
Well, you know, the thing about paradise is that it can be dangerous. The whole culture there in Key West seemed to circulate, at least in that era, around drug and alcohol abuse, and finally there was just too much fun, and they had to escape. In fact, all of my main characters sort of have this wistful memory of Key West, and they loved it, and it was an important part of their life. McGuane told me, I wouldn't want that part of my life removed because so much came from it, but it was kind of a difficult time, I think, for a lot of them. But obviously, Jimmy Buffett went there as a failed country singer, and he found the lost chord of the tropics. I mean, he sort of took Key West and turned it into his career. So there's a lot of good that came out of it, but also they felt this need to get away from it.
So do you think they went there, all these literary greats and wonderful artists and musicians and so on, did they go there primarily just to play and be hedonistic, or did they realize that was sort of tools of the trade and they were going there to do their art?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think when I talked to all my main characters, McGuane and Harrison and Russell Chatham, the painter, it was always, well, we went there to fish. And they did go there to fish, but also there's a really splendid isolation about Key West, and it's such a wonderful community, even to this day, even though it's quite different than it was in the 70s, you're just sort of on your own, and you're away from the rest of the world. I mean, the island is 2x4, just 2 miles by 4 miles, and, you know, you have to deal with people. I mean, if you live on an island, you have to be a lot more tolerant. So you get a wider range of people. You have this real laissez-faire attitude. You know, you can be a famous writer that, you know, might be accosted on the streets in, you know, Boston or New York or whatever, but you go to Key West and it's him, it's Hunter Thompson, yeah. Big deal.
These guys, like, they must be legendary in that little town. Tell me a Hunter S. Thompson story.
Well, I don't know if I could tell you too many Hunter S. Thompson stories that would be heard in a family radio station, but That was the place he disappeared to. In the 1970s, he was kind of the most famous writer in the world, and he was so famous he couldn't work anymore because, after all, he was supposed to be a journalist. And he got in this horrible mess with cocaine. It was the one drug that he didn't really seem to be able to accommodate in his drug diet. And he was also in the middle of a divorce, and so he kind of went to Key West as a retreat. He was anonymous there in a way. I mean, people knew he was Hunter Thompson, but nobody bothered him. But he loved driving around the town in this big old, I think it was an Electra 225. It was a convertible. They call them conk cruisers down there, this gigantic boats of cars. Well, he got a bullhorn, and he would drive down the street, you know, well over the speed limit, you know, "Get out of my way, you sleazy creeps," and yelling things through the bullhorn at people. And for a while, he was the babysitter for my friend Tom Corcoran, who's one of the main characters in the book. Tom and his wife were juggling different jobs, and they had an 8-year-old son at home. And, you know, if one of them couldn't make it home, they'd call Hunter and say, "Would you go mind looking in on Sebastian until we get off from
Hunter Thompson
work?"
As a babysitter? Whoa.
Yeah, he's the babysitter. In fact, Sebastian's a grown man today, but he refers to Thompson as Uncle Hunter. Anyway, Thompson would pull up in the yard. He would miss the driveway, and he'd have his bullhorn and say, "Sebastian, I have arrived. Turn on the nightly news." So everybody in town knew who Hunter Thompson was because he was this crazy guy that drove around the bullhorn. They may have never read anything that he'd written, but they accepted him just because eccentricity is kind of the norm in Key West.
Big personalities, eccentrics, artists, bohemians. I'm speaking with William McKean. His new book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Bill, you married into Key West, and you didn't marry somebody who went down there to escape. You write how she has family roots that go way back.
Right. In fact, her grandfather had moved there in the 1930s as a teenager, working for his father as they rebuilt the remains of the Overseas Railroad and turned it into the Overseas Highway. And he built most of the major structures in Key West through his company. The other side of my wife's family is a Cuban family that's been there for a couple of generations, and her grandmother was used to play in a Cuban jazz band. So I felt that having that kind of background, this kind of entree, really helped out a lot. In fact, when I wanted one of the locals to talk to me and they might be a little suspicious, I'd drop a couple of names, and pretty soon we realized we had some people in common.
For the old-time locals like your wife's family, all these other people can come in, chase their muse, have a good time, get some stories, take good notes, make some music, and then get it done and go home. For the old-time locals, they're there. Is Key West a paradise or is it a trap?
I think they would say it's a paradise because they've been there so long. I do think if you've lived in Key West a long time and the mortgage is paid off and you can afford to stay there, it's great. And I think you do have to keep your pleasure in line because it is possible to have too much fun, as some of the characters in the book will tell you. And I think if you manage to keep that in control, you're doing okay. But it is a culture that has a lot of it based in alcohol. You know, the happy hour starts at 11 in the morning. Mm. There are people at Schooner Wharf when it opens at 9 a.m. who are getting the first beer of the day. So it's a culture really built around a lot of that. And I think it's one of the things about it that could be dangerous. But if you've been there forever, this has been your life, it's not like everyone there is an alcoholic or has had a problem like that. But
it sounds like there's an appreciation just of life, whether it's alcohol-fueled or not. I mean, you write beautifully about how people are proprietary about their sunset.
Right. You know, the sunset is like a place where everyone goes, and they all watch the sun slip beneath the water, the little green flash at the end, and it's just a wonderful thing to look forward to every day. But as I also said in the book, I love waking up there because, you know, you hear a rooster crow in the street, you get up, you go down to the corner, you get your Cuban coffee, and you listen to all these guys talking politics about this island 90 miles away. It's just a great place to go. I love visiting there. I'm so glad that I have family there and we get to go fairly often.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Bill McKean, and Bill's book is Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Bill's got an interactive website where you can learn more about the characters that gave Key West its flavor. And that's simply williammckean.com. William McKean, McKeen. Bill, I'm sort of in the business of sending people to these exciting places and hoping they really have a worthwhile time and are satisfied. And so many places, like Key West, have a big reputation. You know, it was in the 70s, everybody was there. And they go there today and all they find is tourists looking for that magic. Are you likely to be disappointed when you go to Key West today?
You know, I've thought about this a lot because I lived in South Florida when I was a child, and we'd go to the Keys almost every weekend. And then I moved to Florida as an adult and would go there frequently. And as much as you might say about the development in the Upper Keys in particular, and this change and that change and all that, the fact is the Keys are still the Keys, and Key West is still Key West. And driving into Key West is one of the most remarkable, amazing, beautiful things you can do on this earth.
Now, that's quite a statement. And one of the most beautiful things you can do in this earth. Take us there. You're in your, I guess you're not in a conch, what do you call it, a conch car?
Conch cruiser. No, I'm usually in some kind of SUV because I have so many kids.
Whatever. You're coming down this elevated highway. Tell me what it's like. We're driving from Florida, and we're going to go down to Key West. It just sounds so great.
You know, when you hit the Upper Keys and you're driving through Key Largo, you think, what, these are the Keys? What's up? You know, because there's Publix, grocery stores, and all this stuff along the road. But when you get down past, I think it's Tavernier, you go over this big bridge at Jewfish Creek, and then all of a sudden it's just like there's not room for that much development. And it's just this beautiful ribbon highway that's kind of cutting across this water, and you can't describe the color. It's blue, it's green, it's this, it's that. It's just the most remarkable color in the world. And I remember driving down there about 10 years ago with my grown son, and just every 30 seconds we would just look at each other and go, my God, this is beautiful. And so it's that way from Isla Mirada all the way down to Key West, and it's just a wonderful drive. It's just a wonderful feel. And I'm a sort of a road warrior. I've written other books about travel, about, you know, riding Highway 61 down the middle of the country and all this. But I think that's one of the most beautiful drives I've ever made.
Now, this is really kind of uniquely tropical America, isn't it? Our United States in the tropics.
It is. It's there's no other place like this. I don't know that, you know, is there a literary community like this anymore? Is Aspen that? Is it Provincetown?
Well, I was going to ask you that. You got Paris in the 20s, Key West in the 70s. Where is it today?
You know, I don't really know. I think we're all so isolated sitting behind our computers that we're not out, discussing art and literature the way they did in Paris or the way they did in Key West.
Do you think in the 70s they knew it was a great time, like Paris in the 20s, or is that something you only know when you can have the benefit of history to look back on it?
You know, that's a great question. I have a sense that they knew it, but now they love to reminisce about it. They love to remember those days. Mm-hmm. I think the main characters that I were talking to for this book, I think they loved telling these stories and the thought that it would be preserved in something beyond their writing.
There must be a powerful nostalgia. I mean, there were people in their creative prime, in their early adulthood, down there in the 70s. Are some of them just kind of washed up and strolling the streets today and just thinking, man, it used to be so good?
You know, I dealt mostly with this gang of, as I said, McGuain and Harrison and Chatham, and they all live in Montana now.
If you wanted to go down there as a visitor, is there a festival time that's particularly thriving? Or do you want to avoid
Well,
that?
every fall they have the Fantasy Fest, but that's sort of an X-rated festival as far as I know. Every November they have a festival called Meeting of the Minds.
Well, wait a minute. Let's go back to the X-rated Fantasy Fest. What do you mean?
Well, you know...
This is public radio. You can talk about anything.
Well, a lot of people just march in the parade and they're basically nude. Huh. And, you know, maybe they spray glitter on certain portions of their bodies, but they're basically nude. And the book publisher was thinking about how we should do an event then for selling my book when it came out. And I said, well, you know, the problem is, where does a naked person keep their money? You know, how can they buy a book? You know, where are they storing those credit cards? I don't want to know. The week following Fantasy Fest, usually, it depends on the year, there's an event called Meeting of the Minds. And that's a much more harmless event. It's a gathering of all the Jimmy Buffett fans. It's sort of the Parrothead convention.
Wow.
And of course, every July they have Hemingway Days, which of course Hemingway probably would have hated. But you get a lot of people going around dressed like Ernest Hemingway in bush jackets and white hair and beards. And I happen to be married in Key West during Hemingway Days, so I know what that's like. And that was a pretty festive atmosphere. But it seems like there's something going on there almost every week. And you know, there are some very expensive resorts, and if you ask me, they're worth the money. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful places to stay, but there are also these nice, quiet little bed and breakfasts. I don't think it's possible to have anything other than a superior meal in Key West. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great place to go visit.
I'm talking with Bill McKean. He's the author of Mile Marker Zero, A Movable Feast of Key West. Take us just for our last couple of minutes back to the historic roots of this unique culture. I mean, back 200 years ago, it was attracting pirates.
Well, I really enjoyed learning about the history of Key West and the reason it was named Bone Island originally. And it was because there were bones all over the place. When the first Spanish explorers found mounds of skeletons on the beach, and there was no explanation for it. It could have been some residue of a Indian war or something like that. But it was a center for piracy. And then an American businessman decided that he wanted to set up a town there and then turn it into a naval base, which it was for many years until the beginning of the early 70s. And so it's had these many incarnations over the years. It was a naval base. Then it was a cigar rolling center. It was also the sponging capital of the world. It was this, it was that. At a time when it was still isolated, it was not connected to Florida by either rail or highway. It was the largest city in the state of Florida. So it's had this long tradition of reinvention. But it was always rooted in piracy. And so one of the things we discuss in the book is how a lot of the people that were the sort of the business class of Key West in the 70s were trying to deal with the loss of income when the Navy closed the big naval base there. And so out of their shops, their T-shirt shops and knick-knack shops and sandal shops, they sold drugs. That was how the economy was sort of stabilized for a while there in the 70s. You know, but that's in keeping with the culture of this town because it was kind of a pirate town. And I think that that's also part of the laissez-faire attitude of the island. It was just like, okay, Bubba, if that's what you need to do to keep your business afloat, then sell some marijuana. Good for you. No problem. And a lot of the police officers would kind of look the other way if they weren't participating. So it's a strange and wonderful place.
The Conch Republic. Bill, you mentioned in your book that this whole Key West thing is kind of the story of people trying to find home.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these artists went there looking for something, and I think in the case of Jimmy Buffett, he certainly found inspiration. And Buffett found more because when he went there, one of the first songs he wrote about Key West was called I Have Found Me a Home. And he turned Key West in song into this paradise of Margaritaville, which we've heard so many times in our life that we take it for granted, but it's just such a beautifully written song with all kinds of great lines and real sensory images and all of that. But the irony is that they went there looking for home, and then it got to a point where Jimmy Buffett couldn't live there anymore. People would come knock on his door, and they expected him to be standing at the city limits to greet tourists when they arrived. Tom McGuane also found that, he went there. It was his home. He wrote some of his greatest books there, but, you know, eventually he had to leave. So it's, the search for the home actually leads them somewhere else. And it's something I say about writing is that the story you start out to write isn't the story you always end up writing. And I think that's what they learned. They went there looking for something, and it turns out that something was somewhere else.
Bill McKean, author of Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to the Radio Foundation in New York and WBUR Boston for studio help this week, and to Gretchen Straub for reading the travel haiku. Send us a haiku you've written about the impressions from your travels. There's a link in the radio section of ricksteves.com. And we'll see you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.